30% chance of showers, especially this afternoon. Partly sunny, high 79 to 83. Breezy southeast winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight with lows near 63 and sunny tomorrow, highs in the low 80s. South winds 5 to 10. Our lows tomorrow night near 60 and looking ahead to Wednesday, partly sunny, slight chance of showers, highs in the upper 70s. And cooling down a bit more as we get toward the end of the week. KAXE and Stay Human present The Authentic Voice, a live storytelling concert this Saturday, September 20th, 7 p.m. at Clacko Brewing in Grand Rapids. The event features nationally known storyteller Laura Nemi and some of Stay Human's regular contributors, made possible by Minnesota's Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Mount Itasca announces the biathlon trails near Coleraine are closed until next Monday, September 22nd, due to some logging on the east side of the hill. It's time now for a special edition of the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. When Rob Worsham interviewed for his internship, he was asked, "Are you comfortable walking in the middle of 60 black bears?"
I'm retired Army, and I've been in some interesting places, and I was like, sure, why not? 60, I didn't think, you know, that big a deal.
Worsham's now been with the Vince Schuette Wildlife Sanctuary for almost a month.
There's nothing like standing in a crowd of 100 black bears and... Oh my.
The nonprofit American Bear Association runs the sanctuary, which is 10 miles northwest of Orr as the crow flies. There, interns like Rob, volunteers, and a handful of staff feed the bears.
We try to kind of feed them a natural diet. It's just dried fruits, nuts, seed, to complement what they're already going to eat out there in the wild.
Steph Horner is the president and executive director.
There's not fences, there's not cages, they're coming and going as they please, some more than others.
The meals looked a little different when the feeding first started decades ago. Vince Schuette was a logger, and he and his men often dealt with black bears breaking into their camp. After 3 decades of shooting and killing the nuisance bears, he tried something else.
He was like, gosh, they seem to really like my sourdough pancakes, so maybe I should just make them a separate batch. I'll place it away from the cabins and see what happens.
It worked in that it stopped the break-ins. Horner says the troubles of feeding wildlife weren't really known at the time.
Once bears learn a food source, they don't forget a food source, so they continued to come back. I like to say, you know, it wasn't sure it wasn't right, but Vince was ahead of his time. He was trying to peacefully coexist with the wildlife that he was sharing a home with.
More and more people came to visit, feeding the bears junk food and trash.
People were doing crazy things like putting kids on the bears' backs and stuff like that. And so not only were there fears of people getting hurt, but it was super disrespectful to the bears.
The nonprofit began in 1995 and built the first deck for visitors to observe from. 10 to 15,000 people visit each year between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Their admissions, plus a gift shop and photography workshops, fund the sanctuary's work. Horner acknowledges that feeding the bears is no longer best practice, and continuing to do so is controversial. In nearby Net Lake, Boys Fort band members have expressed concern that the practice is making the bears too comfortable around humans, leading to potential conflict. Horner says there's concerns that if feeding stopped, it could lead to even more conflict. Tourists who come to surrounding resorts aren't bear aware, and their poor practices could cause problems for suddenly hungry bears.
But, you know, this is a great opportunity for people to learn about bears and to learn how to be bear aware. So we pride ourselves in being a facility that teaches that.
She says that's why the sanctuary's work is important.
The more people that you teach about them, they're going to learn and understand the animal. They're going to ultimately care more about that animal.
The internship program is another education element. The sanctuary gets 15 to 30 interns throughout the season. Ava Stark graduated from UCLA in the spring with a bachelor's in ecology, behavior, and evolution. Thursday was her last day. She says the highlight was witnessing the magic of bear behavior.
Because I really am interested in wildlife behavior and wildlife conservation, and just the work they do here is great.
With Stark's departure, Worsham is the final intern of the season. He'll be there until the last bear leaves to hibernate. The 56-year-old from Pennsylvania isn't your typical intern, but he was bad at retirement. He's pursuing a wildlife rehab certificate and needed the experience. He also loves the bear behavior.
It's kind of special to see and learn. Yeah, two cubs pretending to be adults going. Because I've been watching just this last week alone, the cubs are practicing adulting.
Despite its history, the sanctuary isn't very well known. Horner says it relies heavily on word of mouth.
I would love to scream it at the top of my lungs and for everybody to know about us.
The Vince Schuette Wildlife Sanctuary is always looking for volunteers, she says, and reopens to visitors again Memorial Day weekend. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
You can hear the latest edition of the Up North Report today at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7:20, Events Up North, taking a closer look at what's going on throughout the region. And that list is also available right now at KAXE.org. In fact, it's an expanded list of what you will hear on air with links and to the pertinent information, all kinds of info at Events Up North. Find it at KAXE.org. Support for KAXE comes from Happy Dancing Turtle, a nonprofit organization dedicated to growing stewards through education, programs, and experiences. More information at happydancingturtle.org. And we thank Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. We do have a chance of showers today, especially this afternoon. Partly sunny, highs 79 to 83, breezy. Southeast winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 63, and sunny tomorrow with highs in the low 80s. Looking ahead to Wednesday, partly sunny, slight chance of showers, and just a bit cooler with highs in the upper 70s. There's more ahead from Morning Edition.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Jerusalem today, holding talks with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nearly 1 week after Israel struck Doha, the capital of Qatar, in an attack targeting senior Hamas leaders. The attack killed at least 6 people, none of whom was a senior Hamas leader, and has now put the U.S. in a difficult position between its strong support of Israel and of Qatar, key U.S. ally in the Gulf. President Trump appeared to address that balancing act in comments yesterday with a warning to Israel.
Qatar's been a very great ally. So Israel and everybody else, we have to be careful. When we attack people, we have to be careful.
Rubio's visit also comes as Israel has intensified its offensive into Gaza City and is gearing up to occupy it. Joining us now is NPR's Kerry Kahn from Tel Aviv. Kerry, Secretary of State Rubio arrived in Israel Sunday. What is he telling the Israelis?
He and Prime Minister Netanyahu met this morning and then they held a news conference. Both reiterated the strong alliance between the U.S. and Israel, and both repeatedly stated that the end of the war would require Hamas's total defeat and elimination and the return of all the hostages dead and alive. Here's Secretary of State Rubio.
As much as we may wish that there be a sort of a peaceful diplomatic way to end it, and we'll continue to explore and be dedicated to it, we also have to be prepared for the possibility that that's not going to happen.
Rubio was asked a few times if that meant that the U.S. was approving of Israel's current offensive to occupy all of Gaza City and displace the nearly million residents there. He did not address that. Both men were asked about the Israeli strike on Qatar, and Netanyahu was defiant and said he would not rule out future strikes. He said Israel will hit, quote, terrorists wherever they are.
Okay, so what is Qatar saying about the attack and maybe any possible retaliation against Israel?
In Doha today, Qatar has convened an emergency regional summit of Arab and Muslim heads of states to discuss a response which it says must be strong and decisive of that attack. In remarks yesterday ahead of the meeting, Qatar's prime minister called on the international community to, quote, abandon double standards and punish Israel for its crimes. He also added that Qatar's efforts to mediate an end to the war in Gaza will continue, but it cannot host Israeli negotiators if it's being hit by Israeli warplanes. And NPR obtained a draft copy of the summit's final statement, which as of now does not include concrete measures against Israel.
Okay, now you mentioned Gaza. What's the situation there now, considering that Israel is moving ahead with plans to take over Gaza City?
The weekend has been deadly. According to health and hospital officials in Gaza, more than 70 people were killed by Israeli airstrikes and attacks. Yesterday, just in Gaza City alone, 35 people were killed. Evacuation orders for the city continue, with the military telling people to get out and move south to what they say are either humanitarian zones or empty spaces with water and services available. The problem with that is, first, people don't have money or transportation to move out, and zones in the south are already severely overcrowded without enough basic services, according to UN agencies. Most of those sites, too, have been attacked by Israel. Airstrikes in Gaza City are intensifying, and Israel has been leveling tall buildings throughout the city, about a dozen in little more than a week. Israel says Hamas uses the high-rises, but has yet to provide evidence of that.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Tel Aviv. Carrie, thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
For more, we're joined by Aaron David Miller. He is a former State Department Middle East negotiator. He's been an advisor to both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
So the UN Security Council condemned Israel's attack on Qatar in a presidential statement that was backed by all 15 Security Council members, including the U.S. How notable is it that the U.S. joined, noting that, you know, it's not a resolution, but it is a presidential statement, but the U.S. did join it? Important?
Yeah, I mean, it's significant, but not determinative. You know, as you pointed out, it's a statement, a consensus statement, not a presidential UN Security Council statement. It's not legally binding. I mean, it shows, at least rhetorically on some level, that the Trump administration is not adverse to joining other members of the international community in dealing with the situation in Gaza and the future prospects for regional peace. It's not a resolution. The U.S. has not condemned, voted for a resolution condemning Israel since March of 1980, a long time coming. And I doubt, frankly, given the Trump administration's views, negative views, on the U.N., whether it's inclined to move any way, shape, or form toward that goal.
So Qatar's prime minister has said that there has to be a quote-unquote collective response to Israel's attack on Doha, but what would that look like? What are some of the possibilities?
You know, you can look at the last 2 years, and you can ask yourself the key question, I ask myself all the time, why, in response to the exponential rise of Palestinian deaths, primarily civilian deaths, the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, which is unprecedented and unparalleled, even by Gazan standards, that the Arab world, Israel's treaty partners, Israel, Jordan, Israel's Abraham Accord partners, the Bahrainis and the Emiratis that have formal diplomatic relations with Israel, why have they chosen not to impose a single cost or consequence on Israel or the United States? So my expectations for what will come out of Doha are pretty low. Mm. I mean, the Arabs hold $4 trillion in assets, not just in the United States, in Europe as well. They're clearly not going to do anything on the military side. Economic boycott, embargo, oil, no, that's not going to happen. And, you know, the U.S., even as the summit takes place, has its major base in the Middle East, Al Udeid, in Qatar. And, of course, we know the Qataris have granted the president of the United States a very expensive aircraft, which I suspect, after being refitted, he'll want to use. So I expect largely rhetoric. It's possible they could threaten to suspend relations with Israel, so the ones that have it. But again, I think they live really in dread of Donald Trump. And I'm not sure we're talking about a major response here.
Interesting. Well, you know, Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is always very solicitous of President Trump when they're together. He constantly praises him and he thanks him. But is President Trump actually having any influence on Netanyahu in getting Israel to end this war?
I mean, there are only two sources of influence, right? I mean, the prime minister's overriding goal is staying in power. To some degree, extending the war serves that interest. He's got to keep his right-wing coalition together, particularly the two extremist ministers who are now talking about annexation. And apparently, Secretary Rubio and the prime minister are going to talk about annexation, partial annexation of the West Bank. The other source of influence, of course, is Donald Trump. And while he has done, I work for Democrats and Republicans, voted for them too. While President Trump has done things that no other American president has done in and around Israel, I mean, he opened a dialogue with Hamas in March without Israel's approval, cut a deal with the Houthis, about which the Israelis learned after the fact, started negotiations with Iran, and lifted sanctions on the Ahmad Shara government in Syria over and above the objections of Benjamin Netanyahu. But Trump's asking himself the question, okay, I'm going to pressure Israel, right? I'm going to get him an end to war. What exactly do I have to do to get Netanyahu's attention? I don't see Trump doing the three things that are available to him. Restrict interconditioned U.S. military assistance, going to war with Israel in international fora, and, of course, recognizing unilaterally a Palestinian state. I think in Netanyahu's current state of mind, first of all, the president's not going to do any of those things. The real question is he prepared to basically say to Netanyahu, look, this has to end, and our relationship, my personal relationship with you and the U.S.-Israeli relationship is turning on a different outcome, and we're going to work together to make that happen. End of war, regional peace. Let's do it. And he should talk to the Israeli public.
But I don't think, what I think I hear you saying is he's not going to do that.
I don't think he will.
Aaron David Miller is a former State Department Middle East analyst, negotiator, and author. He's currently a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Passengers on Charlotte's light rail are seeing more police after a Ukrainian refugee was stabbed to death on a train last month. Widely shared video shows the attacker stabbing the woman from behind. President Trump has called for the death penalty. Nick De La Canal from member station WFAE spoke with riders about their concerns.
Please stand clear. Doors are closing.
It's late morning on the Charlotte Blue Line. A young woman, Ellie Sanchez, sits by a window, backpack at her side. Like many others, she watched the video of 23-year-old Irina Zarutska being stabbed to death on a train by a man seated behind her.
Yeah, I was kind of just angry at the fact that no one really helped her.
She rides the train almost daily to school and uptown to skate and says riding at night can feel different.
Honestly, yeah, sometimes it's just the people are sketchy. Really sketchy.
It's the first killing on Charlotte's light rail since it opened in 2007. Police say violent crime in the city is down 25% this year, and homicides are down 29%. But after the footage was released, the White House quickly blamed Democrats and city leaders as soft on crime. In a statement, Mayor Vi Lyles pushed back, calling the tragedy a failure of the courts.
This stop is Charlotte Transportation Center and Arena Station.
The suspect, 34-year-old DeCarlos Brown Jr., had 14 prior arrests and served 5 years for armed robbery. In another car, writer Lonnie Gaskew says the court system deserves scrutiny.
If they are causing that much violence, like if it's actually like physical violence and hurting people, then I think the courts really need to take into account whether they should be in the public.
In January, after a misdemeanor arrest for misusing 911, a judge released Brown on a written promise to appear in court and ordered a mental health evaluation. His family said he was schizophrenic. Some writers, like Dio Fabula, say they're more alert.
I'd rather sit with my back against the wall, nobody behind me. Yeah, that's why I'm sitting here.
He wants leaders to stop pointing fingers and work together.
I don't think we can pick and choose who's responsible. It's everybody's responsibility.
According to his lawyer, Brown is undergoing a psychological evaluation. Meanwhile, federal agencies are involved in the investigation. Zarutska's family has asked the media not to show video of her killing. For NPR News, I'm Nick Della Canal in Charlotte.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 7:19. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Sarah Bignall joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning. It's kind of a gloomy Monday morning here.
Yeah, there could be some patchy fog out there, which we've been experiencing a lot of.
So there was a day last week, I believe, that it was so foggy out, like you couldn't see, like, you know, more than a couple feet in front of you. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. Not experiencing that so much in Grand Rapids this morning, I don't believe, on your way in, but some areas could be seeing that. Partly sunny later today, although there is about a 30% chance of showers, and that's supposed to be this afternoon.
Okay.
So we'll see. Also breezy southeast winds today up to 25 miles per hour. And it's been a warm morning too. Our temperatures in the 60s already. I mean, I think they stayed there all night, really.
Yeah.
I think they dipped below that. So it's 69 in Brainerd, 62 in Hibbing, 66 in Aiken, currently 70 right now in Park Rapids.
We went for a bike ride this weekend, and some of the leaves are so intensely like red, mm-hmm. and some of the yellows that they have, and I always get nervous when there's chances of rain. I'm like, please don't knock the leaves off the trees,
yeah.
you know?
And when it's windy too.
Yeah, it's like, oh, they look so pretty. Can we just keep them on there for a little bit, while longer? But it's fall, and that's what happens, I guess.
It is. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to have events up north. And remember, at about 7:30, we'll do best wishes. If you've got birthday or anniversary greetings to share, text in 218-326-1234.
Looking ahead at events coming up, there is so much happening in fall in northern Minnesota, including Mount Itasca. They have a biathlon trails near Coleraine, and there will be closing on September 22nd due to logging
closed
on the east.
Closed until September 20th.
So they're closed now.
Yes.
Okay, so you can't check those out. But the Bemidji Community Latin Block Party is happening from 4:30 to 7:30 this Wednesday at BSU.
Yes, we're going to talk with the person behind that, Naomi Carlson, or one of the people, I should say. I'm sure it's taking a group effort, but Naomi Carlson's going to join us at 8:45 this morning.
Yes, we can learn more about that. It sounds like there'll be food and music and games and a lot going on.
Yeah. So it is time for Events Up North, a closer look at what's happening throughout the region this week. And yeah. Watermark Art Center's Poetry Slam season kickoff is this Thursday, Fozzie's Barbecue in Bemidji. Music starts at 6, performances at 7. You can pre-register by contacting the Watermark.
And Greater Lakes Area Performing Arts and Pequot Lakes Community Theater presents Annie. That's going on September 18th through the 21st, as well as the following weekend at the Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Thursday and Saturday shows are at 7 with Sunday matinees at 2.
And the Loon Country Quilters have a quilt show this Friday and Saturday, beginning at 9 a.m. both days at Zion Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids. Over 100 quilts on display, plus a quilt shop, raffle, and more.
You can learn more about carnivorous plants at Lake Bemidji State Park this coming Saturday, September 20th, from 10 to noon. The park's artists and residents will use puppets to explain the wonders of these unique bog plants. You can meet at the Bog Boardwalk for this drop-in event.
And local authors Simon and Lynn Wilson will present a special story time at the Children's Discovery Museum in Grand Rapids this Saturday, 10 a.m. Their book, Learning to Love Your Monster, helps kids navigate anxiety. This is geared toward kids ages 5 and up. There will be a craft time following the reading.
And the 5th Annual Flapjack Festival is Saturday, September 20th from 10 to noon on Laurel Street in downtown Brainerd. There are games and a lumberjack costume contest at 11. Brainerd Early Childhood presents I Touch a Truck during the event, where kids can get a close-up look at really big vehicles.
And Revive Virginia has their annual food truck festival this Saturday, 11 to 6 in downtown Virginia. And that is immediately followed by the Iron Range Barn Dance, 6 o'clock. That's at Colleville Hall in Virginia. You can dance to live music from Leatherwood. All dances will be taught, and all ages are welcome at that event.
The Bemidji Contra Dance kicks off their season on Saturday, September 20th at Rail River Folk School. All ages are invited to dance to acoustic music by the O'Neill Family Band. No experience or partners needed.
So So if you really want to dance this weekend,
there's so many opportunities.
We have a few opportunities for you. And finally, the Grand Rapids affiliate of the National Alliance on Mental Illness has its annual walk, a 5K walk this Sunday, 3 o'clock at Clocko Brewing's parking lot, and a celebration will follow back at Clocko.
Events Up North is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. And if you have events to share with our listeners, you can email us at psa@kaxe.org. And you can look for Events Up North at kaxe.org every week.
So, Sarah, our question of the week, it's about school pictures.
Oh, gosh.
We want to hear about your best or your worst. What was the outfit you had on? Did you remember to comb your hair with the comb, the handout combs?
The little comb, the very tight tooth comb.
Yes.
Most of my photos were okay until I got braces, and I got braces in fourth grade, and you could do different colored bands on them. And one year I had done black and orange, for school colors.
Yeah.
But I had that in my picture, so it looked like I was missing teeth, just big black blanks. And I'm like, oh no, why did I do that? And, I was a child of the 80s and 90s. And so some of the awful, large bang,
poofy hair.
Big bangs, just looking at that of why, but now it's just, that was the time.
Yeah.
It was in style.
That is the thing about a lot of them. Well, it worked well at the time, or we thought it did.
Yeah. Just really, really big bangs. Just bad perms. I had a bolo tie in one.
Oh.
Yeah. A vest that matched my grandmother's couch. The vests were a really big thing for a while.
I had a school photo, eighth grade, with a vest that was kind of a blue Western pattern.
Okay.
I would say.
Yeah.
A little bit with a denim shirt.
Yes. It was kind of youth clothing at that time, I think, could have been for career women in their 40s or, 15-year-olds in, high school.
Yes. Also, my favorite school photo of mine was sixth grade, where I wore this plaid business suit.
Oh, nice.
Red plaid. And it...
Did it have shoulder pads?
It did have shoulder pads. And it came with a skirt, a cute pleated skirt, which I wore for the pictures, even though you cannot see the skirt in the pictures. But I thought, I'm going, full business suit here for this photo. So...
Well, that's funny.
Yes.
Yes. So if you have any thoughts, any memories on... school photos and my kids' school photos, there doesn't seem to be as many kind of odd trends as there was in the 80s and 90s, kind of hair wise and that, they just kind of looked like they had aged.
Yeah.
More of that, but I don't know if you have any fun family or school photos, you could
school photos, and especially if you have a copy, you can take a picture of your picture and text it in
to us, because we would love to see if there's any gems in there. I'm sure there are.
Yeah, if you're willing to share, I would love to put a web story together with a photo gallery later this week if we can get enough.
Yes, I'll have to dig through my stuff, see if I can find the black and orange braces thing. I was wearing a peach dress, and I was like, oh, maybe that match. It was just in my mind, it worked, but
yes.
Oh well.
The number to text, 218-326-1234. We're going to listen to our album of the week now. We get to kick it off on Monday morning. It's called Dark Sky Reserve. It's by Robin Kester. She is a Dutch musician and songwriter releasing her sophomore album. Her music blurs the lines between chamber pop, folk, psychedelic rock, and electronica, drawing inspiration from artists like Portishead and PJ Harvey. She finds writing in English to be more freeing than in Dutch, as she can avoid overthinking the many connotations and associations that words and phrases carry in your primary language. So you can let us know what you think. Text 218-326-1234. Song we're going to hear from Robin Kester is called Perspective.
My eyes. thinking I'm not going to surrender to dreams. So true.
Album of the week, that is Robin Kester. The song was called Perspective, and the album Dark Sky Reserve, we'll be hearing lots more of it throughout the week on KAXE.
And you were saying that you were digging it as it got going there.
At first I was like, not so sure. And then like the drums kicked in and I liked it.
I definitely hear like the Portishead like inspiration to it. So it'll be good to hear more of this.
All right. It is the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Sarah Bignell, and we receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com.
We also receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912, FCFBBigFork.com, member FDIC.
We have a lot ahead here on the Monday Morning Show. Coming up at 7:45, we're going to hear a rebroadcast of what we're reading with Minnesota writer and illustrators David LaRochelle and Colleen Muskie. We'll hear about their vibrant picture book, How to Draw a Tree. Coming up at 8:10, we're going to hear all about Star-a-Palooza with Dave McMillan. That is happening this Saturday at Long Lake Conservation Center, all about the night sky. And then 8:45, our bright spot, we're going to hear more about the Bemidji Community Latin Block Party, which is happening this Wednesday.
A lot ahead on the Monday Morning Show. And up next, is it time for some best wishes?
Yes.
We do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday and happy anniversary. Let's start with yesterday, September 14th. A happy 23rd anniversary to Nancy Schmidt and Bill Wilson of Bemidji. Alan and Michelle Voorhees are celebrating their 41st anniversary from Bemidji. And Chuck and Kathy Miller are celebrating their 51st anniversary from Cohasset. And Xander Grotejohn is celebrating a birthday yesterday from Grand Rapids.
Today is September 15th. Aaron and Heather Johnson, happy 18th birthday to you in Bemidji, our very own. And Lauren Mendoza, happy birthday in Minneapolis. Claire Buntrock is 66 today in Shorewood. Dan Ellis celebrating 41 years in Bovee, and Don Snow. Happy 66 to you in Blaine. Our best wishes to you all.
Yeah, and if you would like to say happy birthday, happy anniversary in your own words, we always invite any thoughtful, you know, little messages. You can email that to us at comments@kaxe.org.
Yeah, and preferably if you can do that a few days ahead of time.
And not, you know, 4 minutes before we do it, you know. But yes, give us some time to plan.
So we're going to hear some new music from Mount Joy. This one they're teaming up with Nathaniel Rateliff from the new album Hope We Have Fun. This one's called Wild and Rotten.
I won't lie, you make a fool out of me. Got me rolling around on roller skates, trying to protect my knees. You thank God, I thank family, all the real good liars about the way things seem. Like a friend, and shot it into the wind. She said, let me go.
That is new music from Mount Joy featuring Nathaniel Rateliff. It was called Wild and Rotten from their new album, Hope We Have Fun. It is the Monday morning show on KAXE. Hope you have a fun day today.
Yeah. You know, a fun day.
You know.
On a Monday.
Not as much as you can on a Monday.
Yeah. you know, it's days like this when the sun's not out, it's sometimes a little bit harder to get up and rolling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's somebody that's over, Jennifer, you probably can't see them, over at the music park here.
Yeah.
And it's an older man, and he has taken off his like outer kind of layer, and he is like going to town on like the xylophones over here. So maybe he's trying to wake himself up.
Yeah. And have some fun today.
He's having some fun. So we received support from the Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering the brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. And the Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. on Monday, September 22nd at KAXE. This is an open meeting. Members in the general public are invited. For more information, you can email comments at kaxe.org or call us 218-326-1234 during regular business hours. You can find the full board's calendar at our website, kaxe.org, and they meet the fourth Monday of the month.
And we thank Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Hoff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. It's time for our daily dose of phenology, the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, September 15th, 1999, I am entranced by the lovely color of the poison ivy. I say the lovely color, certainly not going to wander about admiring each individual plant. But this time of year, the plants shift from the green of summer to a beautiful kind of a corally orange fall color that will gradually fade into red, and then the leaves will fall off. That doesn't make the poison ivy any less toxic. If you are in touch with the wooden stems of the poison ivy plant during the winter, you can still get some of that oil on your skin. And for 50% of the population, that means a rash, an itching rash. So admire the beautiful coral red of the poison ivy, but stay out of the patch, especially if you're like me and you are one of the 50% susceptible.
That is our daily dose of phenology. You can tune in tomorrow morning at about 7:20 for John Latimer's latest observations. And hopefully we'll have lots of student phenology reports for you, too. That will start about 6:45. I have the privilege of co-hosting tomorrow with John Latimer.
Oh, do you? It's always fun this time of year as the kids are noticing either birds migrating out or the leaves that are changing.
Yeah, and we're getting those, you know, we've got fresh classrooms. School just started.
Yeah.
So I know we heard from Little Falls last week, but I think as we get close, you know, more into the school year, those classrooms are yeah. Going to find their groove, and we'll be hearing from them more.
Yeah. So. It's fun. I love Tuesdays.
Yeah.
Get to hear kids excited about being outside.
You can always let us know, too, what you've been seeing in nature. If you have, like, photos of things, you're like, what is this? You can either join our Facebook group, the Season Watch Facebook mm-hmm. group, or you can always text in 218-326-1234, and we'll make sure John Latimer sees those as well.
Yeah, there's a wealth of knowledge on the Facebook group that I oftentimes, when people are like, I saw this, or can you help identify that? And
yeah, saw some interesting mushrooms on there. I glanced at it this morning, and like these bright red, like really round mushroom.
And I've been noticing more mushrooms. Like I have a trail I walk every day that I don't recall seeing in past years. And one, I'm mad at me not taking better, you know, like notes of
oh yeah
that. But usually there's like these big like puffball kind of things, like these perfectly round mushrooms. And I haven't seen those this year, but I have seen like bright orange and bright red mushrooms that are really big. Like they're, I mean, maybe
like
CD like diameter.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
Like,
that's
yeah,
big. Like
big.
I always think of the Smurfs.
Oh,
and some of these mushrooms is like, that looks just like where the Smurfs would live.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was out in my backyard yesterday. I was actually doing a little lawn mowing, and mowed over a puffer.
Oh, did you?
A puffball, like just a small one. And then I had some other mushrooms too in my yard that I thought, well, it hasn't even been that wet, has it?
No. And I've also found mushrooms that are like low, like maybe just a half inch, but like a large, like probably a, you know, 8-inch round in the ground. I don't know. I'm like, that's a little unusual. And I thought it was too dry this summer, but you know, that maybe mushrooms would need more moisture. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But somehow conditions have been ripe for fungi.
Yes. So whether it's that or anything else you've been noticing in nature, you can text us 218-326-1234. Right now, it is time for what we're reading.
Yep. Minnesota writer and illustrator David LaRochelle and Colleen Muskie's a lovely and vibrant new picture book, How to Draw a Tree, teaches us to slow down and observe every part of a tree.
David LaRochelle and Colleen Muskie are both Minnesota writer-illustrators. They've teamed up for a new picture book from the Minnesota Historical Society Press. It's called How to Draw a Tree. This is simply a lovely book. The story itself is by David LaRochelle, and Colleen Muskie's illustrations of children interacting with different types of trees are soft, vibrant, and utterly pleasing. The message here is to take the time and observe with all of your senses. This is sound advice for young artists, but also great advice for all of us. How to Draw a Tree is for ages 3 to 7, or anyone who wants to slow down and enjoy something beautiful. It's time now to hear from David and Colleen in our What We're Reading conversation. This book is so timely for us up here in the Bemidji area. It arrived just days after that big storm we had, the derecho with the hurricane force winds that downed thousands and thousands of trees in the area. We don't even actually have an official number. So the loss of trees has really transformed our landscape here. So it was just so meaningful to see this lovely children's book of yours arrive. David, can you tell us what the inspiration for the book was?
I was inspired to write the book by a couple of things. One is I just love trees. They are beautiful. I have on the second floor studio where I am, I can look out and I can see several different trees, and they're beautiful all year round, just the way their branches look, even without the leaves. But the other thing that really inspired the book was something that one of my art teachers told our drawing class back when I was in college. And he said, you should spend at least as much time looking at your subject as you do looking at your paper when you're drawing. And that is so true. I have found that over and over again. And it's not easy to do either. I know when I'm drawing, I have an image in my head, or I think, oh, this is how a tree looks. And I start drawing it on my paper, and I'm just focused on my paper. And when I do that, I draw the same tree over and over and over again. It's sort of a staple tree. But when you spend time to actually look at different trees, the variety is incredible. And that's really the same thing with anything that you draw. I can do the same thing with people. I have a staple little boy that I draw and a staple little girl that I draw. But when I start looking at kids in real life, the variety is so, so different, and you don't notice that unless you spend the time to make an effort to do that.
Great. Colleen, can you talk about how you became involved with this project?
I actually think David maybe saw me online and could tell my love for trees also, and then passed my name on to Shannon at the Historical Society Press, and then they contacted me.
Can we get into the collaboration process of this story, of this book? How did the two of you work to put those words, put pictures to the story, figuring all that out? David, do you want to start? And then Colleen?
And that's one of the things about children's books that a lot of people don't know, is that so often the author and the illustrator do not collaborate, do not work together. And that was the case for the most part with this book. I wrote the words, and our editor at Minnesota Historical Society Press, Shannon Pennyfeather, we did the editing on the story. And when the story was all set, they turned it over to Colleen, and it was all in her hands after that. I think the only comments that I made is that it was really important to me that there was a wide variety of trees and a wide variety of locations. And if you look at Colleen's drawings, you can see she did that so well. And she would have done that on her own, I'm sure, too, even without that input from me. But that's what was important to me. And then she took away, and then I got to be delightfully surprised when I saw all of her artwork.
Yeah, Colleen?
Yeah, that is true that we usually don't interact with each other too much. I did reach out and contact David just to see what he was thinking as far as the type of trees and were we going to stay Minnesota local because it was the Minnesota Historical Society Press or expand. And he was really interested in expanding, which made it way more interesting to pick some unusual trees we don't necessarily see here in Minnesota. And then it gave me more freedom to do some different landscapes where those trees belong, which I had a lot of fun. I find it interesting that we don't chat with each other. It makes it so I don't want to say I don't have any obligation to the words. I do, but like I'm, as a writer also, when I'm writing those words, I have a vision in my mind about what I am trying to write. But as just the illustrator, I have a freedom to kind of do with those words with what I want. And I don't have any preconceived notion about what's tied to those words. So it actually gives me a little bit more freedom to be the illustrator and not the writer illustrator.
And that ends up bringing so much more creativity to the book. And that's, you know, I've illustrated books myself, but when it's turned over to the illustrator, it's in that person's hands. I shouldn't be saying, okay, draw a pine tree on this page, draw a girl who looks like my niece on this page, because Colleen came up with all these wonderful details that I would have never thought of. And that's when a picture book works well, it's when the two of us are bringing our own ideas to the book. And I feel so grateful that Colleen was the illustrator for this.
And it is a beautifully vibrant book. And you're talking about details. And I'm kind of curious, Colleen, if when you're doing the art, when you're creating the vision that you have to go along with this book, if you could speak to the details, like what inspires you to add a little bird on the branch here or a little, you know, a little leaf fluttering down in the corner there. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about those little flares and details and what inspires you to add those?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just kind of my personality. I'm a maximalist when it comes to artwork and like interior design or any of that kind of stuff. But I also remember reading stories to my kids when they were little, and they loved the little critter books. And in every page, there's like a little spider and a little, I think it's a grasshopper that they have to find. And they loved those details. So I try to do that. So it goes beyond the story and about trees and drawing and observation. And there are other things to look for when you read the story over and over again.
You're listening to What We're Reading on KAXE. And we're talking with Minnesota writer illustrators, David LaRochelle and Colleen Muskie. Their new children's picture book is called How to Draw a Tree. So David, one of the things that I think really shines about the story in this book is that there's this balance between art and imagery and science. I think that the book can not only help kids learn how to describe what they see in nature, but that those words and concepts help them understand some of the science between the different trees, I think. One example is the Joshua tree. And would you care to read that description out loud for us?
Sure. And that page goes like so. There are so many words that could describe a tree. Prickly, shimmery, scraggly, squat, ancient, graceful, crooked, proud. What words would you choose? And I'll just, you won't be able to see it, but just holding up the page there. When I wrote those words, I had no idea of having a Joshua tree in my brain. That was something that Colleen brought to it herself. And this joy of having the illustrator add her ideas and her creativity.
Obviously, we're talking about trees, and I can't let you guys go without finding out what your favorite trees are. So, Colleen, what is your favorite tree?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a hard question because I love so many trees. I have a special connection to linden trees. My first story I wrote and illustrated is about a linden tree, and they have so many helpful ways to help people and the environment, which I really love. But if you're going for my heart tree, I would say I have a soft spot for willow trees.
What do you like about them?
I love that their branches are, you know, not rigid and moving and swaying. And my husband and I visit New York every couple of years, and we go to this one place that has the oldest willow tree I've ever seen in my life. And it's enormous. It's like three stories tall, and you take 10 people to put your arms around it. And every time I go, I take a picture of it. It's just so beautiful.
David, how about you?
Like Colleen, that's a very hard question to answer. I know that I was blown away the first time I went to California and saw the sequoia trees. They just didn't seem possible that these could be that big. And I knew they were big, but I had no idea that they were that huge. And the other tree that I would mention, one that we don't have just generally in Minnesota, and now I'm not going to think of the name of it, but like along the ridge of the Grand Canyon, there are these maybe cedar trees, and they're twisted in the wind. Colleen, do you know the name of those trees? I should be able to.
Oh my gosh, I'm trying, because that was actually one of the trees I was thinking of where that Joshua tree page was. That tree, and I want to say it's some kind of a cedar tree, because the oldest tree in the world is that type of tree, I believe.
And the branches are just so fast, the way they're twisted and so weathered looking, but they continue to hold on even in those huge windy conditions where they live.
Trees are so symbolic that way. We get so much from them. That's wonderful. I just want to thank you both so much for this book and for talking with me today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
David LaRochelle and Colleen Muskie are the team behind the new picture book, How to Draw a Tree. It's what we're reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.
What We're Reading is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. What have you been reading lately? You can text us 218-326-1234.
And I'm in the middle of Atmosphere by Taylor Jenkins Reid, and I'm enjoying that so far. It has to do with women in the NASA program in the late 70s, early 80s, and I've enjoyed her books.
Yeah, and this is a fictionalized account of this.
Yeah.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, and I have, what is it, The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, she also wrote, and I really like that.
Daisy Jones and the Six.
That one I saw the series or whatever, right. and I didn't love that, but I might read the book because that I think.
Yeah, that book I didn't love because it was very much like a behind the music like format, like how they were writing it, like where it was like, you know, kind of in an interview format. But then I guess it wasn't all of that, but a lot of it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did enjoy The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo a lot by her.
Yeah. And then Carrie DeSoto is back is another book of hers that follows tennis, kind of a prodigy. Like she was, you know, this super talented young whatever that she comes back to play tennis in her 30s.
Yeah. So old.
So old. But I really enjoyed that. So. Digging that. How about you?
I am currently reading a Lorna Landvik book, which I thought I had read all of her books, but this one I discovered at the library. I was like, oh, I have not read this. It's called The View from Mount Joy, I think it came out maybe like 15 years ago.
Okay.
Enjoying that quite a bit so far. She also has a new book that's what I went to the library to look for. And it said it was on the shelf, but somebody must have checked it out in between the time.
No.
Either that or it was on the new shelf and it was misclassified or something. But I am enjoying The View from Mountjoy.
That's good. Yeah, I've had lots of very heavy books that I had read, and I've been trying to find something that's lighter, and it seems like no matter what I pull, it's like, burr, burr, like I just need something that will be